3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognize their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast.
Oh, yeah.
Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show with me and Rob.
Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning.
I love your drip this morning. Hannah's dripped in full Adidas swag.
Tracksuit all the way.
Sorry, tracksuit. tracksuit swag.
It's jammy time.
It is jammy time. It's 7:01 in the morning.
It's 7:01.
And I think it's still socially acceptable to wear pajamas.
Exactly. You're not going to catch me in hard pants before 11 a.m.
Yeah.
Soft pants.
I saw over the week this influencer that I follow, Kian Toomey. He got emailed by his hotel because he, like, you know when you go to a certain kind of hotel and they give you a robe and slippers?
Yes.
Yes, as a concept, we know of that. he, like, went from his hotel room in the hotel robe and slippers to, like, walked out onto the street. And, like, I don't know, bought a bottle of milk or something.
As he should.
And then he went back in, but they emailed him. They emailed him saying, like, please don't.
Wear it outside. Don't leave. Why?
And I'm like, why is it not socially acceptable to wear your hotel robe and slippers?
He should be allowed to wear his slippers.
Get a bottle of milk, you know?
I'm wearing my slippers right now.
You're wearing your slippers right now. I'm wearing my Kmart Crocs. Anyways, how was your weekend?
It was good. I have a chesty situation.
Oh, no.
As you can hear from the rasp in my voice.
Yes. I thought it was just your...
The morning vibe.
Your usual beautiful tenor in the morning.
Yeah. What did I do on the weekend? I worked all the way in Dingley Village yesterday.
Oh, I'm aware of Dingley Village. That's a bit of a trek, right?
It was a mission.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
hour drive
out west from me.
No, it's like down the coast, like on the way to Frankston.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. I've definitely been to Dingley Village before somehow.
Yeah.
Watched
an AFLW game.
Cool.
Yeah. It's pretty good.
Nice.
Can't remember.
Well, I know the pub footy league is having their finale on the 25th.
Really?
Yes.
Oh my god.
We should go.
Yes. My friends in the Flippies team.
On Love the Flippies. Flippies.
Yep. We should watch.
What's their name? Do you know?
Can't remember. Zebras? Anyway. No, not zebras.
I know there's like
maybe
the unicorns
zebras.
And they actually dress up as unicorns. They're
That's
like one
really
of the
cute.
Longest teams and longest standing teams in the league.
I love that. What is Flippies? I feel like it might be unicorn. No.
Oh, we'll find out. Anyway, we'll find out. TBC listeners.
Yeah.
So anyways.
I don't have the facts. I don't have the pop footy facts.
Well, a bunch of us from 3CR went to Concrete Gang's 50th birthday on Monday.
Oh, yeah.
And that was really beautiful.
That's good.
Happy birthday to the Concrete Gang.
Happy birthday.
Show. It's really
wow,
special.
50 years. That's
50
a long
years.
Time. Wow.
Yeah.
Same age as 3CR, pretty much.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, and it was really beautiful to feel so much history in one room, you know?
I'd like to listen back to some of their first shows.
Yeah, you actually can on the 3CR website.
Oh, great.
I think there's 5 episodes.
Cool.
Let me get the link. Anyway, I will come back to you with the link, but you can listen to them on the 3CR website.
Nice.
Because people have donated, like, old tapes and stuff that they have.
Love archiving.
Anyway, we'll get back to you with a link.
What did you do on the weekend?
Too much socializing.
Oh, yeah.
And I, like, ran out of steam.
Yeah.
I was going to go to a gig on Saturday night, but then I completely ran out of steam. And I was like, I was having a nap at 7:30 at night on a Saturday night. And I like hadn't had dinner, and then like doors had already opened for the gig. And I was like, yeah, this is not happening.
Yeah.
So just like, because I had like a brunch and then I had a lunch and then I saw someone else after that. And I was like, why have I done this to myself? Like, I wanted to be in the space to be like, because it was four bands.
Mm.
Two of them are like vegan death metal. One of them's like straight edge hardcore.
Mm-hmm.
And another is just like super cool, like mosh death metal band from Melbourne called Algo Mortis. Mm. But it's definitely the kind of gig you need to be like
ready for.
You need to be mentally prepared.
You need to.
And it was at Max Watts. I don't know if you've ever been to Max Watts, but it's like,
yes, I have.
Logistically,
the downstairs one, right?
Yeah, and there's like no service, and so you're like locked in.
Yep.
And it's just like logistically not a good venue for metal gigs.
But maybe it is good in the downstairs darkness.
It is good in the downstairs darkness, but let's. So there's like steps down into the mosh pit.
Yeah.
So like people stand on one of the steps. So like once you're in the mosh, you're just in.
You're in it.
You know what I mean? So like that's what I mean. It's like if I'm going to go to a death metal gig on a Saturday night, I've really got to have my wits about me. All of these like tall dudes, you know, standing around ready to like throw hands and stuff.
That sounds fun.
That was my weekend.
That sounds fun. I ate a lot of delicious food on the weekend, actually.
Yes.
I think I've been living like I'm rich. I like eat every meal out at the moment.
Damn.
I had pho.
That's so tough.
I had laksa. I had ramen.
Mm-hmm.
I had so many soupies. It was so good.
So many soups.
So good.
Well, it's a good time to get it in before it starts to get warm, you know?
Yeah, I know. It was light this morning.
Mm. It's kind of jarring.
Yeah.
Should we talk about what's coming up on the show?
Yes.
Before we yap about soup more?
Yeah, let's do it.
We're going to start off the show by hearing an interview that aired originally on Thursday Breakfast last week, in which Priya spoke with Adu Hani, who's the secretary of the Renters and Housing Union. They had a really great conversation about the union's success with collective tenant bargaining and, yeah, what that means for future tenant organizing here in so-called Victoria. And they also spent half of the interview, speaking about rental reforms coming into effect on the 13th of October. I think they're really important for listeners to wrap their heads around. And also good to have the Rahu perspective on the rental reforms, not just the Victorian government saying, like, we love housing when, yeah. Anyway, following that, we'll be hearing from David Glanz, who has in part organized a forum to unite people against racism, which is taking place this Wednesday. So we'll be hearing from David Glanz talk about that and, mobilizing against Pauline Hanson. Mm-hmm. And at around 8 o'clock you have an interview, Hannah.
Yep. At 8 we'll be joined by two environmental and human rights activists, Violet Coker and Colette Harmson, and they'll be talking about National Endangered Species Day, which is today, and the importance of protecting them and how direct action can help protect endangered animals and how people can get involved in fighting to protect them as well.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
That's going to be so good.
Yeah. Should we get into the headlines?
Sure.
Some folks know about it, some don't. Some will learn to shout it, some won't. But sooner or later, baby, here's a ditty. Say you're gonna have to get right down to the real nitty gritty. Right down to the real nitty gritty now. One, two, nitty gritty now, yeah, boom. Nitty gritty, hoo-wee. Right down to the real nitty gritty.
The nitty gritty,
hoo-wee.
These are the news headlines for Monday, the 7th of September. The Albanese government has approved a BHP coal mine extension in central Queensland called the Saraji Mine Gravilla Pit Continuation Project. An extension of one of Australia's largest coal mines has been approved to continue mining for another 30 years. Greenpeace Australia Pacific has called it, quote, an affront to Pacific leaders and communities grappling with climate disasters and a reckless move that undermines Australia's partnership with the Pacifics as the PM meets regional leaders at the Pacific Islands Forum, end quote. The announcement of this extension came at the same time as a report by the UN is warning of dangerous climate overshooting. And 2 months before Chris Bowen, the federal climate and energy minister, is attending the climate negotiations at COP31. Climate change researcher Dr. Simon Bradshaw has said, quote, "We are witnessing dangerous climate change driven by the production, export and burning of fossil fuels, wreaking havoc across the world. Continuing down the path of fossil fuels and approving new coal is an act of recklessness at a pivotal moment in the world's energy transition and response to the climate crisis. Communities must not pay the price for fossil fuel greed," end quote. Dr. Simon Bradshaw also said, quote, "No more double talk. Australia must get squarely behind long-standing Pacific leadership on climate change, fight to protect the all-important goal of limiting warming to 1.5 degrees, and ensure that COP31 builds further momentum in the global transition away from fossil fuels," end quote.
In other news this week, Reuters has reported that NextDC, an Australian data center company, has reported profits above forecasts as its water and energy use rise for the third consecutive year. NextDC has a data center running next to Tottenham Station here in so-called Melbourne. In the year leading up to June, it recorded 2.40 liters per kilowatt hour, which means that for every 1 kilowatt ran per hour, this center is using 2.40 liters of water. The data center's energy usage has also jumped in the past year, with its power usage effectiveness, a measure of how much electricity the building requires for cooling, rising from 1.44 to 1.49 in 12 months. In the same period, its revenue rose 16% with a $80.21 million profit, a huge swing from its $60.5 million loss the year prior. A rally was held calling for a moratorium on data centers in early August, which walked past the NextDC data center and was organized by the Borderlands Cooperative and community organizations such as Citizens of Tottenham. The organisers demanded a temporary pause on the construction of data centres until Canberra can legislate stronger guidelines for communities and people across the continent. These have been the news headlines for Monday, the 7th of September, 2026. You're listening to 3CR Community Radio.
One Nation is hoping to break through in the Victorian election. Anti-racists are out to stop them. Unite Against Racism has called a public forum at Trades Hall in Carlton, 6:30 p.m. on Wednesday, the 9th of September. Be there to hear great speakers and get involved. Unite Against Racism is initiated by the Refugee Action Collective, a 3CR supporter.
Join the Homeless Persons Union Victoria on our new radio show on the mighty 3CR.
Listen in as we embark on a public experiment to grow a homelessness union from the grassroots and on the radio.
Tuned In, Locked Out is a new monthly show on 3CR that seeks to grow a homelessness union in public view and to a wide audience.
We'll speak to people involved in community development, to allies, activists, and anyone who has anything interesting to say about homelessness issues in Melbourne today. Most importantly, we will centre the voices of people who are homeless in Melbourne and beyond.
Featuring interviews, guests, as well as analysis of policy, laws and media discourse that affect the homeless community.
Tune in on 3CR, 855am on Tuesday, September the 8th, 12am to 1am for our premier broadcast.
Tuned In, Locked Out is a proud affiliate show of 3CR.
In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air.
What's that up there on the airwaves? Is it 3AK? Is it the ABC? No, it's 3CR. Faster than Schildberger. More relevant than Mike Willacy. Able to get more writs than Darren Hinch. Yes, 3CR. With music and interviews totally off the planet. With powers and abilities far greater than commercial radio. And who, disguised as a mild-mannered community radio station, fights a never-ending battle for truth, justice, and the non-commercial way.
3CR, celebrating 50 years.
3CR, your station, your voice.
Do a bit of disrupting and cause a bit of ruckus in the colony.
Always was!
Not celebrate Australia, but instead pay homage to the resistance of First Nations people against this illegal colonial occupation.
3CR, your station, your voice.
This country's black future is a fire. With the right season, that burning school fire.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR, 855 AM on the dial. Just wanted to mention that link that we mentioned to listen to archival episodes of The Concrete Gang are at 3cr.org.au/concrete gang history. We can put a link to that in our podcast notes for the show if folks like. We're now going to listen to an interview that aired on Thursday Breakfast last week, in which Priya spoke with Adu Hani, who's the Secretary of the Renters and Housing Union. And they spoke about collective tenant bargaining and its implications for future organising here in so-called Victoria. And they also speak about upcoming rental reforms, which come into effect on the 13th of October across the state. And what that sort of means for the state elections. This first, we've split it into two parts. This first part talks about the union's recent success with collective tenant bargaining.
Thanks for joining us in the studio. I'm excited about the topic that we'll be talking about today, because I think this concept of collective tenant bargaining has been a challenging one to get off the ground in so-called Australia, even though we do have, you know, forms of tenancy where people all do have the same landlord, like public housing traditionally and community housing. It's been a lot more challenging to engage in that kind of organizing when it comes to private rental tenants. So can you maybe start us off with a bit of the principle of collective tenant bargaining and what that means in this context?
Yeah, absolutely. And maybe also a bit as to why it's been challenging historically in Australia in the private rental market. So in other countries like Canada or Spain or Sweden, you can walk up to a big block of units and it'll all be owned by the same landlord. You do that in Australia and every single unit can be owned by a different property owner. So it's much more difficult to traditionally collectively bargain like tenant unions do in those countries. So historically in Australia, it's been difficult to kick off. But the principle behind collective bargaining is very similar to that in the labor unions, where you find a single employer, you get all their workers together, you get them in a room, talk about their issues, and then figure out what you do from there. And that can be as simple as sending a letter outlining your demands very clearly and what you need, or it can be as severe in advance as a strike. Mm. And so like how workers walk off the job if their demands aren't met, tenants can withhold their rent if their demands are not met. But that is a quite that's quite a later step. That's quite a big step. And so, as I mentioned, there's many things in between that, that tenants can do to exercise their bargaining power. And the main idea is that, you know, by yourself, you don't have a lot of power against your landlord and your agent. You know, your landlord and your agent have wealth, they have experience, they have professionals, they have stability. Whereas, you know, by yourself, you have a lot of tenants don't have those things, right? Mm. And landlords are able to, you know, take advantage of that. But if tenants get together, there's a sense of security in a collective. And also your bargaining power increases significantly because all of a sudden it's not just one flow of income that's being threatened to the landlord. It's all of them or a vast majority of them. And so the landlord has to take that seriously if they want to maintain their operations as is. Mm. And so it's the ethos behind collective bargaining is harnessing that power to get a fairer outcome for tenants.
Yeah, I mean, I think it is a really powerful thing to have tenants being able to identify their relationship to each other through the same landlord and to then talk about what they want together. But, you know, without giving too much of your strategy away, I did want to ask about how you've been able to operationalize this here because, you know, a lot of folks live, for example, in, you know, detached dwellings where they may be share housing, and it can be kind of difficult and opaque to tell who your landlord is, let alone how many other people share the same landlord.
Yeah, absolutely. We have been able to get around it, which is great. In South Australia last week, we fought off a 5% rent increase for people who live in a share house, or a few different tenants who live in share houses. So we have found ways against it. I'll say it's a mix of lots of research, but also landlords and their agents can be quite sloppy. They haven't been challenged in a long time. And if I had to give them a piece of advice, you know, be a bit less open. You know, where things are out and open much more than they think. And we're able to find things pretty easily. Mm. So that's probably the most I can say about strategy.
Yeah,
but no. I think the important thing to emphasize is that if you have a landlord and the landlord is mistreating you or you have various problems and you want to pursue something like collective bargaining, we are able to link up all the different tenants of that landlord. Let's say they have three properties in North Melbourne, three in South Melbourne, a couple out in, I don't know, Werribee. We're able to link you guys all up and, you know, create a group chat or invite you all out to some kind of event or something and collectively bargain from there. And we can do that across state bounds as well. If they've got properties in, I don't know, Queensland, we can bring those tenants as well. We've got a Brisbane branch now. So, you know, we're able to establish those networks.
Yeah, I mean, that's incredibly exciting and I think has big implications for the future of tenant organizing here. I did want to ask you about some of those implications, but also if you could take us through some of the recent wins that you've had. You just gestured to one before.
Yeah, in South Australia. One in Victoria we had last week. We fought off an 11% rent increase from the landlord. We also are in the process of getting urgent repairs done. So that's been getting done this week. There's been, mold doctor coming in. There's been this, that, various problems at the property being addressed. So that's been a really big win. Those tenants, they were, served an 11% rent increase. And this is, you know, over short, medium term, this is thousands of dollars. You know, it's a lot of money for tenants. This can be life-changing for tenants. This will be life-changing for tenants. It just means for the landlord, their property is slightly less lucrative. So.
Mm. And I did actually just want to ask a follow-up on that, which is, are you seeing when you have these sort of collective bargaining cases that the same sort of measures are being applied across different properties? So was it that everybody got an 11% rent increase or, you know, are some people getting it, some people not? And then in other cases where you're challenging conditions, is it that the same landlord is letting all properties run down? What are the sort of patterns that you're seeing as you start doing this?
It's really heterogeneous. It really varies a lot. So sometimes the agent or the manager will be very much trying to control everything. They'll be the kind of arbiter. Sometimes the landlord is willing to have a conversation or to be a point of contact. Sometimes we have to hunt down the landlord figuratively, obviously. We have to find out, you know, who they are, where they are, any points of contact, and sometimes they still refuse to negotiate. So it really varies across every case, to be honest, how cooperative and how good faith landlords and their agents are. I will say I've noticed a significant trend of landlords and agents not being, not operating good faith, which may come to a big surprise to many of your listeners.
No.
But yeah, I would say that they try and, in my experience anyway, more often than not, landlords and their agents try and shut down negotiation. They try and monopolize the flow of communication. They try and minimize the transparency of information. They try and really reinforce that information asymmetry where tenants don't have access to a lot of information and landlords have access to all the information. So, but it does really vary. So for this specific one, to get back to your question, sorry, it was just a 11% around all the same time. But sometimes that will vary. Sometimes just vary, depends on when people sign the lease and whatnot. Mm-hmm. But sometimes one person 1 month will get one, maybe the next month. It does vary a lot depending on the case.
Well, I think it does show a lot of promise for tenants being able to leverage some collective power. And I think, as you said, you know, it is unfortunate that you're seeing landlords and real estate agents not being, you know, on balance amenable to coming to the table. But I think they will also possibly realize this is in their interests as well. If you think about the sort of transaction costs of having to undertake an eviction and going to court or VCAT and then having to re-tenant the property, you know, and at the end of the day, it does seem like there is some leaning to the power imbalances that already exist where, you know, this is an investment property for the landlord and this is the home for the tenant. But it is really good to hear that people are feeling, you know, more emboldened to engage in that action.
We put so much effort to try and get them to the negotiating table in good faith. We try and get to that point where they're not, spending so much time and money and resources on this and that. And it's just, you know, time and time again, despite our attempts to establish good faith negotiations, we don't really get anywhere. So unfortunately, the only thing that seems to work more often than not are those more direct tactics and escalations. And yeah, as I said, we put so much effort into trying to establish those communication lines to negotiate and have a good conversation. But, you know, if push comes to shove, I'm going to pick the living standards of my members and tenants over the comfort of a particular landlord.
Mm, well said.
If you're a renter with problems such as repairs, getting your bond back, negotiating a rent hike, or facing eviction, it helps to know your rights. For free information and advice on renting, you can visit Tenants Victoria at www.tenants.vic.org.au, Arnica Legal at www.anikalegal.com, or contact your nearest community legal centre. The government is planning to demolish and redevelop high-rise public housing towers in Melbourne. If you're living in a public housing tower and need free legal advice about your options, find your nearest community legal centre at www.fclc.org.au. The Federation of Community Legal Centres is a 3CR supporter.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR Community Radio, 855 AM on the dial. That was Priya from Thursday Breakfast speaking with Aduhani. secretary of the Renters and Housing Union, speaking about the union's recent success with collective tenant bargaining and, yeah, what else happens and that those implications for further tenant organizing here in so-called Victoria. We're going to keep going with playing that interview. This second part is about the upcoming rental reforms which come into effect on the 13th of October and key commitments tenants should be mindful of when it comes to the November state elections.
And now I just wanted to turn towards the next raft of changes that are coming up for Vic renters. So these rules will be coming into effect. They've already been passed in legislation, but they come into effect from the 13th of October. And we have a couple of different changes coming through that will affect, the rental conditions of Victorians. What do people have to look forward to and what should they be mindful of?
Yeah, so the ones for October will be strengthening bond claims. So rental providers must notify the renter in advance. They'll be making a claim on their bond at the end of the agreement. Landlords must keep records of them complying with minimum standards when it was advertised for rent. Landlords must ensure that mandatory gas and electrical safety checks are done every 2 years. Landlords must do a gas check before draft proofing. And then there's also now a ban on rental providers and agents charging any fees for applications.
Mm.
So it sounds kind of very boring and, wordy. And they're minor reforms, but they're positive reforms. Mm. This is about, making sure that, for example, with bond claims, that tenants, that landlords aren't getting away with dodgy bond claims. Some of the stuff that we've had to deal with is people just not being aware of the rights they have around claiming their bond or the fact that it is their bond.
Yeah.
We've dealt with cases so egregious that the landlord didn't actually file the bond with the bond authority. They just kept the money for themselves. And, particularly we now have tenants who maybe English isn't their first language or they're struggling because they're working a couple jobs and they've got kids at home and they just don't have the time to go through the legislation. All of a sudden, that's a couple thousand dollars that they can't get back.
Mm.
And so, things that we've been able to do, for example, is win that money back and then refer the landlord to Consumer Affairs Victoria and get them fined. So, and I think that leads into a broader point about legislative changes is that these are good changes, but they're not worth the paper they're printed on if they can't be enforced. What the literature says time and time again is even if you increase regulation, even if you put all these new laws into practice, if they're not enforced, then they're not really worth much, right? And the thing that's keeping them from being enforced is the fact that tenants fear retaliation, they fear their landlord. The landlord and agent have more knowledge, they have more experience, they have professionals on their side.
They have resources.
They have resources that tenants don't have. They have time, security that tenants don't have. And so if there isn't a force to counterbalance that, then there's no one there to enforce these laws, or there's not a lot there, and so that's where we come in, and we tenants' union are able to enforce these laws.
In wrapping up and building on that point, when it comes to enforceability, what will you be looking to in the upcoming state election? What are some of your key concerns, and have you seen any moves in this space that look encouraging?
Unfortunately, when it comes to elections, discussions about renting and that side of the cost of living crisis haven't been too prevalent in public discourse. Whenever housing is brought up in the public discourse, it's usually about home ownership and how it can institute relief for people who have mortgages and interest rates and property prices and this, that, and the third. And these are all important discussions, but it seems to overtake the really pressing rental crisis that we're seeing across the country and in different states. And that's no different here than in Victoria, unfortunately. If we look at the Liberal Party or One Nation, very rarely do they ever really talk about renting. And if they do, it's you know, in regards to One Nation, it's they talk about in relation to migration. They never really talk about it in relation to anything else. And when it comes to the Liberals, they're often the ones saying that we need to cut back all these new protections that renters have won. We need to cut back regulation, red tape, and all that stuff. So, you know, unfortunately, from the conservative side of politics, it's not too promising.
Yeah.
We're seeing some good rhetoric from the left side of politics. So obviously, the Labor Party is instituting these new reforms. The Greens have been strong advocates. The Victorian Socialists have been strong advocates for renters rental reform. But overall, the public discourse can often leave the question of renting out, unfortunately.
Yeah, well, in that case, it is up to tenant organisers to keep the pressure on, and we really appreciate the work that the Renter and Housing Union does. And thank you so much, Adu, for joining us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
That was Priya from Thursday Breakfast speaking with Adu Hani, who is the Secretary of the Renters and Housing Union, speaking about both the union's success in collective tenant bargaining across Circle Victoria, as well as the upcoming rental reforms which come into effect on the 13th of October. Of course, you can listen to more from Priya and co on Thursday Breakfast at 7 to 8.30 on Thursday mornings, or go to 3cr.org.au/Thursday Breakfast. We're now joined on the line by David Glanz, who is an organizer of an event coming up this Wednesday, Building the Fight Against One Nation, and a member of Unite Against Racism. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for waking up early to join us. Tell us about who is involved in organising this forum.
Yeah, well, Unite Against Racism has been going for a little while. It was initiated by the Refugee Action Collective, but it's brought together organisations on the left, organisations which are anti-racist and pro-Palestine. And so the public forum we've organised for this Wednesday night is currently endorsed by 43 organisations, including the Maritime Union, the National Tertiary Education Union, the Victorian Greens, the Australian Manufacturing Workers Union, and a lot more. So people are coming together because they recognise that One Nation represents a real and growing threat to working class people in general, people of colour, migrants, refugees, and indeed the whole working class. So we have a forum this Wednesday night at Trades Hall at 6:30. We've got four great speakers and time for discussion. And we're from that forum, we're going to be launching a rally against One Nation, against the racism and against the far right on Saturday, October the 24th at the State Library at 2 o'clock. So that's a little bit far down the track, but if people want to put that date in their diaries, it would be great. We want to see a massive number of people out on the streets saying no to racism and no to One Nation.
Right. So on Wednesday night, tell us a little bit about who will be speaking.
Yeah, we've got four speakers on Wednesday night. Radhi Bafflot is a Tamil refugee who has been at the heart of refugee organising against the Labor government's hostile policies against refugees. We have Imam Alaa El-Zokum, who is the Imam of the mosque at Heidelberg Heights. So we're very pleased to welcome him, because a very big component of One Nation's racism is Islamophobia. And so it will be good to hear from the Imam. Uncle James Williams, who's a proud Waka Waka man, and he's also the Greens candidate for Essendon. And then we have Lucy Honan, who is a teacher, an Australian Education Union counsellor, a leading activist in the Fight the Crisis rank and file group. And that's important because the teachers' struggle, which was over the last 6 months or so, which has reached really heroic heights, is a very clear indication about how you can take on the failure of the Labor government at state level. But the Labor government is not doing such a great job at federal level either. You can take on their their policies without giving any ground to One Nation. And the teachers showed it's possible to fight against the cost of living crisis and the crisis in public education without giving Pauline Hanson one skerrick of support. And so that's why we'll be looking forward to hearing from Lucy.
Mm. Yeah, David, a little bit of a pivot, but I actually listened to your podcast published on Solidarity's website about dialectics. And so obviously, like, within dialectics, you talk about how, like, things are always changing, right? And so I wanted to ask you how this election run by Pauline Hanson and the One Nation Party in general is different from their previous attempts.
Well, that is a bit of a pivot, but yeah, one aspect of dialectics is the way that quantity can turn into quality. So small, gradual changes can very suddenly turn into something quite dramatically different. And obviously, we hope that's the case with class struggle and the struggle against capitalism, but that process can also work its way through with the far right. So 2 years ago, One Nation got 6% in the federal election. Now, on most polls, they're sitting on around 30%. They've just won a Labor seat, supposedly safe Labor seat, in WA in a by-election. And so there's a very real danger that One Nation will suddenly go from having one upper house member in Victoria who nobody knows about, who's completely irrelevant, to being a substantial force. And obviously the real worry is we could end up with a Liberal One Nation coalition government after the November 28th election. And that would mean the Deputy Premier would be from One Nation. It means some of the ministers would be One Nation. And that would dramatically shift politics in Victoria. We pride ourselves on being a progressive state, but we would have people in government who are anti-union, anti-abortion, anti-trans, anti-migrant, anti-refugee, and with some real power. And that's why I think it's so important that we organise now against One Nation, with the forum on Wednesday, the rally in October. We're producing thousands of leaflets that people can use in their workplaces and communities. But we will keep organising after November the 28th, because there's a real danger that racism will become really thoroughly embedded in Victorian politics. So we can't just have a short, sharp campaign around the election campaign. We have to be ready to organise in the new year against a heightened level of racism in Victoria and indeed nationally.
Mm. And I think it's really important that, as with the speakers you mentioned at the forum, you've organised on Wednesday at Trades Hall, that the speakers are from, like, very different areas of this fight against racism. Right, it's a very intersectional set of speakers.
Yeah, I think that's importantly the case. I mean, racism at the moment is being directed towards migrants, but One Nation, pardon me, is clearly aimed at. Sorry, a bit early in the morning.
That's okay.
One Nation is clearly aimed at demonising Muslims. They're pushing at a door. Open door that's been created by the so-called war on terror over the last 25 years. So Labour and Liberal have led the way with hostility to Muslims. Remember, on the very same day that Pauline Hanson said there are no good Muslims, on that very same day, Anthony Albanese said he would not lift a finger to help the so-called ISIS brides and their innocent children returned to Australia from Syria. There's the Prime Minister of the country telling us that Muslims are dangerous. Of course, it makes it much easier for Pauline Hanson then to sharpen up that argument. But yes, Indigenous people are targets of racism. Refugees are targets of racism. And we want to hear those voices on Wednesday night alongside a clear fighting militant union voice as well.
Mm, absolutely. David, we only have a few moments left of the interview. Is there anything you wanted to add about Unite Against Racism or the upcoming rally on Saturday, October 24th?
I think the simplest thing is to say find Unite Against Racism, Vic, on Facebook or Insta. Begin to follow our messaging come along on Wednesday, 6:30 at Trades Hall. I think it won't just be a meeting where we talk. It'll be a meeting where we organise, because we now have 2.5 months between now and the election. But we will also be organising to create an anti-racist network that will be on the streets in October, and then we'll continue to organise against the One Nation political cancer after the election on November the 28th.
Mm. Well, thank you so much for joining us on the Monday Breakfast Show, and we'll be sure to put the details for the forum and the upcoming rally in our podcast notes for the show. Thank you again, David.
Thanks for having me.
And that was David Glanz, member of Unite Against Racism, a newly formed organization organizing against racism here in so-called Victoria, who, as they said, has organized a forum being held this Wednesday, the 9th of September, 6:30 p.m. at Trades Hall on Lygon Street in Carlton. To help build the fight against One Nation, and we'll be sure to put those notes, those details in the podcast notes that we publish for the show. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show. Stay tuned.
One Nation is hoping to break through in the Victorian election. Anti-racists are out to stop them. Unite Against Racism has called a public forum at Trades Hall in Carlton, 6:30 p.m. on Wednesday, the 9th of September. Be there to hear great speakers and get involved. Unite Against Racism is initiated by the Refugee Action Collective, a 3CR supporter.
When I was new to Melbourne, I found a Food Not Bombs flyer on the road, and I had like this fist with a carrot, and carrots are my favourite vegetable. Yeah, I think they were asking for help doing stuff, and I got in touch.
We, I guess, rescue food
that would otherwise go to waste.
I like the aspect of sharing food and not making anyone feel obligated to pay anything for it.
We make a real point at Food Not Bombs of involving everyone who wants to be involved in whichever part they want to be involved in.
For more information, go to fnbmelb.noblogs.org. Food Not Bombs is a 3CR supporter. Food Not
Bombs. You're listening to 3CR, an apartheid-free zone. 3CR's Committee of Management has passed a declaration formalising our commitment to a free Palestine. As an apartheid-free zone, we're committed to boycotting Israel's regime of oppression. We stand firmly against apartheid in Palestine and encourage other organisations to join us in this struggle. Visit our website to read the full declaration and learn more about our commitment to justice and liberation for Palestine and the apartheid-free zone movement.
We know you love listening to 3CR, but we also know that many of you haven't downloaded the Community Radio Plus app yet.
The app lets you tune in anywhere and share the station with your friends.
So, show the love and share the love and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
Trans Family is a not-for-profit organization providing a peer support group for loved ones, including parents, siblings, extended family, and friends of a trans and gender diverse person. Trans Family runs discussion groups in person and online. We offer a safe space to share your experiences, ask any questions regarding your situation, and provide peer support. We are especially keen to hear from loved ones in regional and rural Victoria. Donations to TransFamily are tax deductible. For more information, visit transfamily.org.au or look for us on Facebook. TransFamily is a 3CR supporter.
So I built a home in the rain and the smoke. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR. That song was Signing Off by Daisy Picker. We're now joined live by two environmental and human rights activists, Violet and Colette. Good morning.
Good morning, Hannah. Great to be here again.
Great to have you again. Always a pleasure to have you on the show. How are you both doing this morning?
Oh, I'm pretty good. I'm a morning bird, but I think Gaffer,
I'm a night owl, so I'm still sleeping.
Yeah, even though I do the breakfast show, I do struggle every morning, every Monday.
Power to you. Well, thanks for having us chat about this really important day, though, because it's Threatened Species, National Threatened Species Day today, the 7th of September. Mm-hmm. And, we obviously have a massive extinction crisis going on around the globe. In fact, in Victoria alone, we have 1,960 threatened species in our care, in our area. And so we just wanted to come in and share with everyone how important it is to think about all these other creatures that we share this world with and how responsible we are for their lives and ultimately the crisis that they're in as well.
Mm. And do you want to also start off by telling me the history of both of your environmental activism and how that ties in with, you know, when you're fighting to protect forests and ecosystems, of course, it's also to protect the many endangered species that live within them. And do you want to like speak about your history with environmental activism and how that, you know, is also fighting for endangered species as well?
Absolutely. Yeah. Gaffer, go first.
Yeah. So I live in Lutruwita, Tasmania, and I am primarily a forest activist. So I'm very much focused on ending native forest logging, but also I'm a veterinarian. And so I've worked with animals and their welfare and just witnessed firsthand all the terrible things that are happening that make it really hard for wildlife to coexist on this planet while we have a climate emergency. And so, I focus very much on the habitat for those threatened species and, just witnessing firsthand, how much is jeopardizing their lives. I work in Lutruwita, Tasmania, and there's a lot of threatened species and there's also a lot of challenges for those human-caused challenges that are causing more and more animals to become threatened in Lutruwita, Tasmania.
There's a huge logging crisis in Tasmania. They won't give it up. And same here in Victoria. So we, apparently ended native forest logging here in Victoria, but of the 21 contracts they had with the loggers when they ended native forest logging, 19 of them were renewed under the Forest Fire Management Scheme, which basically bypasses all environmental protection. So Gaffer and I met because I was originally a climate activist primarily, and we were both facing prison for our activism. And I just blocked the Harbour Bridge in Sydney, Gadigal. And Gaffer was facing prison for the forest frontline. And it was such a beautiful union of the two kind of pieces of this puzzle between, you know, fighting fossil fuels and fighting the environmental destruction frontline. And so we've been fast friends for maybe 5 years now. Yeah, causing trouble together. And that's exactly what we're going to do today, cause some more trouble.
Do you guys know about, you know, how National Endangered Species Day came about and the history of this day?
Yes, yeah. Well, so you've probably heard of the Tasmanian tiger, which is extinct. And in 1936, there were some captive Tasmanian tigers in a zoo in Nipaluna, Hobart. And on September the 7th, 1936, the last Tasmanian tiger in captivity died. And then the species was said to be functionally extinct or extinct. That is how National Threatened Species Day came about, because of the extinction of the Tasmanian tiger in Lutruwita, Tasmania.
I recently did an interview with someone from the Dingo Conservatory, and she was talking about how protecting... She gave us an example of this farmer in WA who let dingoes be on his property, and he saw the trickle-down effect of the whole ecosystem improving by the waters ending up running clean, and all of the trees and the bush came back, and all of the invasive animals like goats and foxes all left the property because the dingoes restored the ecosystem. And she also spoke about like the struggles of protecting these dingoes and how the government is like allows and supports the killing of dingoes as well, and how there's a real stigma around dingoes and the lack of protections for dingoes legally as well. Do you guys want to maybe talk about the importance of having like, and how the government currently is if they are working towards protecting endangered species or, you know,
No.
Oxymoron.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, often we are sort of presented with this idea that humans are this apex creature on the planet that can survive and manipulate the environment perfectly. But the reality of the situation is that we kind of live more in like a Jenga house, and every piece we take out makes our capacity to live on this planet more and more unstable. And biodiversity and all the creatures that make up those biodiverse ecosystems are, you know, as you say, keeping our waters clean, are maintaining and pollinating plants and bush medicine and food and the, you know, trees that clean our air. All these things are interdependent on each other. And what we're finding now is that, you know, farmers are having to self-pollinate their crops and go in with paintbrushes and pollinate crops because there's not enough bees and those sort of things, which all have these knock-on effects. You know, I heard that the magpie populations are dropping because they're quite a long-lived bird. They live for 15 years, but because of temperature spikes and all these sorts of things, that their babies aren't surviving into maturity. And so, yeah, I can't imagine a world without the magpie warble, to be honest. But beyond the beauty of all these creatures that we share, they serve such vital functions for our own habitability, and they have a right to exist unto themselves, even if they don't serve us, to be honest. But yeah, I think a lot of people are driven by their own capacity to live and their children's capacity to live. And yeah, Threatened Species Day is not just about making sure we've still got platypuses around. It's also about making sure that, you know, we have a livable planet for everyone and everything.
Mm.
And the government really doesn't care. I mean, it seems so driven by profit, and it seems so content on this false idea that we can just manipulate our environment to our own whims without the aid and assistance of the other living creatures that we share this world with. And you know, I think I'd like to see their science on it, because I mean, I'm sitting here with a vet, and I can tell you the best science tells us that, you know, we need to live in harmony with the creatures that we share this world with.
Mm.
Do you have anything to add, Colette?
I guess, you know, reiterating some of those points with the intact ecosystems and you know, when you take out species from those, things start collapsing, and yet, you know, you get unbalanced areas where there's, you know, die-offs and things like that, and especially in Tassie, where you have that, some of those connectivity, those corridors with intact forests and with waterways that are thriving, and you start developing that kind of that stuff with land clearing, with mining, putting in new bloody AI centers,
data centers,
that kind of stuff, and you just throw the tipping point over. And, you know, we can talk about science till the cows come home. We know that we're right with all that kind of stuff. But at the end of the day, if our governments have decided they're going to ignore that, then we have to stand up and do something about it.
Mm. And so how can people get involved in fighting to protect endangered animals? Is there anything happening today for National Endangered Species Day?
Yeah, well, there's a crew of us heading to Department of Energy, Environment and Climate in Action, that's DECA, which is on 8 Nicholson Street in the city. We're all going to meet at the southeast corner of Carlton Gardens at 11:30. Most of us will be dressed in black as mourners, so if anybody wants to come and join us, you're very welcome. And we are going to go and occupy the office of the DECA building. We've got some information flyers about them. That's also the building where the Environment Minister's office is. And we're going to share with them our disappointment in the fact that they're continuing to destroy habitat in Victoria, and also, you know, take time to just mourn those creatures who have become extinct in the time that this government has been in charge of protecting them.
Mm.
And I think it's important also to just recognise, and it's hard for me to fathom, that Australia is the number one mammalian extinction hotspot on the entire planet. So every single country, and we're number one for mammalian extinctions, and
we're mammals, so not least. we are leading the way in mammal extinction, and I think there's not enough emphasis on our responsibility in that regard, because once a creature goes extinct, that's it. There's no bringing it back. We don't have Jurassic Park to like reanimate them. You know, we actually just lose that opportunity to work with that creature and live with that creature and for it to be a part of our world.
Mm. And Colette, how has your experience of being a vet been with, like, what have you seen, like, been happening with endangered animals that maybe come in to your care, and what's your experiences with that?
Well, I'm not practicing as a vet these days. I'm a full-time environmental activist, but as a vet and as someone who has worked with animals in that context, there's definitely, you know, the animals are suffering from the climate emergency, from the increased temperatures and the floods and the fires and that kind of thing. It's having a huge impact on wildlife. And so alongside the humans who are desperately suffering in these times, you know, the animals are too. You know, without those intact ecosystems of all our species, we're going down a bit of a slippery slope somewhere that maybe it's not very comfortable to think about.
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the hardest things, is that people don't really want to think about it. It seems like such a massive problem, and that people maybe feel out of control of the situation. And when you don't have control of a situation, it's easy to kind of put it in the too hard basket and push it away. But the reality is that we do have power. We have power as a community, as a collective. And over time, we can apply that power and pressure together. And it starts with little actions like today. It builds to massive marches like the End Native Forest marches that happen all around the country with the Bob Brown Foundation in March. And in the middle somewhere there, there's going out into coops and actually stopping the logging with your body, which are all things that people can participate in with us. So come and meet us. You know, you can find me on social media, Violet Coco, or Colette Harmson.
You'll find me in Lucha Witta. But also today, dressing up as a morning M-O-U-R-N, morning, to be sad and distressed about all the dead threatened species that are, you know, this is going on under the watchful gaze of conservative governments, and they're doing nothing about it.
So again, we're meeting at 11:30 a.m. at the southeast corner of Carlton Gardens.
Cool. Well, thank you so much for coming onto the show today, and maybe I'll see you at 11:30.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Thanks for coming onto the show. That was Violet Coco and Colette Harmson speaking about the importance of protecting endangered species on National Endangered Species Day. You can meet them and get involved by meeting at 11:30 a.m. at the southeast corner of Carlton Gardens, to then go to Dika to mourn endangered animals. You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show. Stay tuned.
Stay tuned, stay radical.
We demand the full restoration of all Indigenous lands and resources, and we demand the immediate cessation of all forms of exploitation and destruction of our lands.
We're here to remind you of our sovereignty and our original demand from day one.
It started with intentional genocide of our people around the round table in England. It's all lies here. Everything's a lie. It's a great opportunity right now to step into a sovereign, independent republic.
We demand a treaty. We demand our lands back. We demand to stop Black Death in custody.
ReCR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au.
You're listening to the Monday Breakfast Show on 3CR, and to end up the show, we're going to be listening to a few excerpts from 3CR's Tuesday Home Time, where Jan Bartlett spoke to Ken Davis, the International Programs Manager of the APHEDA Union Aid Abroad, who begins the segment with a background on the current state of education for younger children in Gaza since the intensification of Israel's siege over the past 3 years. A content warning that this interview mentions violence against children. You can listen to the full discussion with in-depth reports on the West Bank and other interviews from Tuesday Home Time by going to 3cr.org.au/hometime-tuesday. Stay tuned.
Obviously, after 2006, there's, you know, big blockade in terms of the sea, the Israel border and the Egyptian border. But on and off, some things were coming through from Egypt. So the situation after October 23 is very different. And now maybe 2 million, 2.1 million surviving people in Gaza are confined to an area near the sea on the west. Israel's occupying more than 60% of Gaza. That's in the north, in the east, and in the south. There's militias there funded from Emirates and Israel, Palestinian militias like Islamic State and also supporters of former supporters of Fatah that are operating on the Israeli side, and all of that area has been leveled. So all schools and everything, all houses, schools, infrastructure, mosques, everything on the Israeli side, what they call the green zone, has been leveled and rubble is being taken away, presumably with not just rubble, but people's possessions and bodies that were under the rubble. On the Palestinian side, a lot of the schools were damaged, and of course a lot of the schools became areas for people to set up tents, you know, from the people who'd lost their homes, because maybe the majority of people on the Palestinian side of the enclave, you know, are in tents. Because there's a lot of distress amongst the children, obviously, I think there's been a lot of efforts with UNICEF and local Palestinian organisations and some international organisations to do, I don't know what you'd say, psychosocial support, or, you know, like programs for singing or like with clowns or activities, but also to try and bring the kids together to have recreation. This is a really important psychosocial intervention in areas of crisis, you know, similar to what was done, for example, in Aceh after the tsunami. But the other effort is to try and re-establish functioning of primary schools and high schools. I mean, there's some electricity and certainly some very, very small solar. Schools are re-established in partial buildings or in tents, help of various international organisations, but relying on local, like teachers and so on, to try and get school kids back into regular life. And also with the high schools, people maybe are mainly trying to study on their phones in as much as there's Wi-Fi or electricity. But there's also like gatherings, at least in tents, if not in partial school buildings. And the big event for, you know, in Palestine is the equivalent of the high school certificate, the announcement of the results of the end of the secondary schooling. Even under siege or, you know, in relation to the genocide, it's really important for the children to feel that they're able to graduate primary school. Even if there's no actual building of a primary school, and certainly for people to graduate the high school. And so that's, you know, celebrated when it, you know, when it happens, despite all the adversity.
And I'd imagine that there was a great need for teachers. I mean, we know that Israel targeted people who were important in society, like health workers, journalists. Did the same thing happen with teachers?
Look, I can't remember the current figures, but it was, last I looked, it was more than 600 teachers killed, and certainly a lot larger number of students. I think it's slightly different with journalists and health workers, that health workers and journalists have been like deliberately targeted. I think the schools and teachers are killed or injured during routine attacks, and certainly there's still, there's daily attacks, like daily bombing from Israel, as well as, you know, violence from the pro-Israel militias, and also increasing conflict between big clans or big families inside Gaza. So a lot of teachers have died, and, you know, and some people have been able to leave and some people have been medically evacuated. But, I mean, there's still a lot of people capable of teaching there, and people, even in tents, people need to try and make their lives more regular to try and go on, even if they don't have jobs or like enough food. It's important to try and reassemble makeshift schools and like people to go to church and mosque, even if the buildings are destroyed.
And that's the thing, isn't it, with education for Palestinians? It's always been a high priority. over many decades, centuries.
Absolutely. It's so culturally, it's really important. Palestinian diaspora, also there's big celebrations of high school graduation or university graduation. And in Gaza in particular, there were 12 universities, majority of students were women. Some of those universities, very high quality. You know, before the genocide, people would be able to try and, you know, go to higher studies, for example, in Turkey or, you know, other Arab countries or Europe. So that the professional base in even in Gaza was you know quite high in the sense of doctors or engineers or professional people, and the linkages between the 12 universities in Gaza and outside were considerable. Even now, people with degrees from the good universities in Gaza are applying for scholarships in places like Italy or Spain or Ireland, and that's one of the only ways people are getting out.
And what's left of those 12 universities?
Nothing. I mean, physically nothing. But, not nothing. There's ruins, particularly, for example, people really like the Islamic University buildings, you know, which were specially designed and seen as prestigious. So, you know, buildings that had social significance were very much targeted by Israeli military. And, of course, the really central historic places, the old church is sort of still there but was damaged. But the Omari Mosque has been destroyed. The castle, the Basha Castle near it has been destroyed. Part of eliminating the cultural and intellectual heritage has been the destruction of the universities. And so international organisations and Palestinian NGOs and whatever are trying to re-establish university study, and a lot of it's online, but collective university study with makeshift structures. You know, so our partner Man is working with Al-Azhar University to try and re-establish not buildings, not good buildings, but to, you know, like a study environment in, I don't want to say demountable or tent structures.
And where does the power come from?
I think there's still limited power sold from Israel, but I think the power that used to come from Egypt has stopped. And a lot of the big solar, you know, which was on the top of buildings, particularly, you know, like the community buildings or education infrastructure, the solar that was on the top of buildings is largely damaged or destroyed. But people are using like small-scale solar units that might put in the road in front of the house so that you can charge phones or, you know, which is the main thing, or have a little bit of lighting.
And where does internet fit into that?
I think the teams inside Gaza, I mean, ultimately Israel has always had the ability to take down the internet in Gaza or anywhere in Palestine. And they've done that on and off. But local teams re-establish, you know, where towers have been damaged or like routers and stuff have been damaged. Local teams are re-establishing that all the time. So, you know, like my friends I'll be talking to, they'll say, oh, you know, it's down or the whatever, but, you know, the guy's trying to get the system up and running again. And that's on a very localised area with localised solar.
Can you talk a bit more about connections with universities maybe in Europe or America?
There's some universities in America advertising scholarships, but I don't know if that's happening. But my friends in Gaza have said they've got friends that have got scholarships to Italy and to Spain and to Ireland. I don't know if anyone's going to like Turkey or Arab countries. But, you know, there was, I think 300 went on scholarship to Italy a couple of months ago and scholarships are open. So this is maybe not a gesture by the central government, but by particular universities in European countries. They're taking people mainly with good, you know, bachelor's degrees.
There must be many thousands of young people in Gaza who had ideas of going on to university or continuing maybe further studies.
That's dashed at
the moment. And there's, you know, you talk about some students, but it's still really a slice, isn't it, of those who really need to have that education.
Yeah, well, and people need to remember the demographics of Gaza. You know, prior to the genocide, maybe more than 50% were under 18. And so you've got really, really large populations in primary school. know, in preschool, in primary school, in high school, or the equivalent of high school, in colleges and the 12 universities. Also some, you know, with Al Quds University, like distance learning, like in a fairly disciplined way. But people maybe underestimate the intellectual capacity in Palestine and in Gaza, and the value of most of the universities in Gaza, and the cultural attachment to like proper education, like people becoming doctors or engineers or lawyers or professionals.
And what assistance are they getting from what you might call Islamic societies?
That's sort of contradictory. You know, like traditionally, like Qatar and Turkey and Malaysia and Indonesia were big donors, but other Muslim regimes have traditionally been very hostile to Hamas and to Gaza. So, you know, for example, the Emirates, which is funding the pro-Israel militias, like on the, in the, what the Israelis call the Green Zone. So, yes, that's quite contradictory. I mean, there's enormous support amongst the people of various countries like Algeria or Indonesia, for example, but that doesn't necessarily translate into good government support at the moment. And, of course, Indonesia was volunteering for the Board of Peace for the Stabilisation Force. But now what seems to be happening, or what's been announced by Israel, is that they're building bases for troops for from Kosovo, Morocco and Uganda. And that, you know, relates to the process of Hamas's offer to disarm, and what, you know, what the details are of that and who else is disarmed.
Just finally, Ken, do you believe that there is pressure now, or mightn't be a great deal of pressure, but pressure on Israel as more and more of these facts become to light, particularly when you look at the ABC now, who I believe have been sort of supporting Israel for so long, are actually turning the...
And that was Jan Bartlett speaking with Ken Davis, who is the International Programs Manager at AFIDA, Union Aid Abroad, speaking about the current state of education for younger children in Gaza since the intensification of Israel's siege over the past 3 years. Obviously, that segment mentioned content discussing violence against children. If this affected you, was distressing towards you, please call Lifeline at 13 11 14. Or Indigenous listeners can also call 13 Yarn at 13 92 76. Of course, you can listen to more from Jan Bartlett on Tuesdays from 4 p.m. or at 3cr.org.au/hometime-tuesday. It is 28 minutes past 8 in the morning. I just wanted to do a quick reminder to listeners that the MUA is calling for support at their picket, at their quantum picket at 54 Mackenzie Road in the Docklands. A company is trying to bring in scab labor to unload a ship. So yeah, they're calling for support from 7 a.m. today to help stop scab labor.
And before that last segment, we were speaking with Violet and Colette about National Endangered Species Day. If you want to get involved with the action that they're putting together today, you can meet at 11:30 a.m. on the southeast corner of Carlton Gardens to go to Deka to mourn endangered animals.
And before that, we heard from David Glanz, who is an organizer within Unite Against Racism, who have organized a forum happening this Wednesday at 6:30 p.m. outside Trades Hall, speaking about building the fight against One Nation and, yeah, what happens post-election as well. And the show started off with an interview from last Thursday's breakfast show in which Priya spoke with Adu Hani, Secretary of the Renters and Housing Union, about the union's success with collective tenant bargaining and the upcoming rental reforms which come into effect on the 13th of October. And with that, we'll see you next week. Stay tuned for Women on the Line.
Bye.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.